Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Everything is Possible, Anti-Fascism and the Left in the Age of Fascism, by Joseph Fronczak. Narrated by Rick Adamson. Prologue. The History of the Left. When no one's asking, I know very well what the left is, but then I'm asked, and I don't know anymore. Jacques Julliard. What is it? A revolutionary movement? But all is calm. The questions, and the complication, belonged to Simone Weil. She was in Paris, writing in early June 1936 about the factory occupations then sweeping through the city and its surroundings. Weil, a 27-year-old philosopher who wrote on topics ranging from work and strikes to revolution and war, had just visited several of the occupied factories, including the Renault plant, where she herself had once worked while on leave from a teaching post. Now that the Renault workers had grabbed control of the grounds and were occupying the plant, Weil had returned, hoping to soak up what one of the strikers called the pleasant feeling of being lords and masters of a place where they usually toiled, their immediate world momentarily turned upside down. Weil found the scene inspiring, and she found it puzzling. How to square the perfusive sense of revolutionary possibility, not to mention the outright seizure of the means of production, with the emotional calm. And how to square the calm with the explosion of sit-down strikes, as they came to be called, across Paris's industrial landscape. By the time Weil wrote out her questions, the movement, revolutionary or not, had brought the region's manufacturing to a standstill, hitting the largest firms and smaller operations alike. And by the time her words appeared in published form a couple of weeks after the Renault strike, the sit-down movement had spiraled from the factories into all sorts of workplaces splayed across the city, the cafes, hotels, and department stores, the grocery stores and markets, boutiques, bakeries, and workshops. Weil thought that the suddenness and thoroughness of the movement suggested something fundamental, something transformative, but she still could not shake the sense that all around her the mood was too light, as if those waging the revolution, again, if that's what it was, didn't understand that it shouldn't be all smiles, songs, and affection for those who embraced each other as equals. The puzzlement was not Weil's alone. It was a slapstick sort of revolution, dealing in comedy instead of blood, a close observer in Paris suggested in the wake of the strike wave, but its results were far-reaching enough to make French workers date their calendars from the day of strike settlements, just as Mussolini tallies history in terms of the years since his march on Rome. The Echo de Paris, a daily paper popular on the right, felt it necessary to warn readers not to be fooled by the facade of good humor, songs, and innocent diversions. Make no mistake, the newspaper insisted, all those strikers occupying their workplaces meant that a revolution has begun. Indeed, the Echo went so far as to claim, all revolutions begin like this. 2 months later, Weil boarded a train bound for Barcelona, a city by then in the midst of a revolution of its own. The revolution in Barcelona, to be sure, had not begun with good humor or innocent diversions. It had begun with deadly street battles involving swarms of the city's people fighting against soldiers of the Spanish army. The fighting had taken place in late July during the first few days of the Spanish Civil War. It had left as many as 500 dead and countless more wounded. Yet, somewhat miraculously, when it had ended, in control of the city were the common people of Barcelona, syndicalists and anarchists, the women who kept the working-class neighborhoods running, the community-based militias, rowdy teenage laborers, the local barbers, and factory workers in faded blue overalls. And in the days that followed the violence, even as they buried their dead, the people of Barcelona threw the city into a state of social revolution much like what they had witnessed in Paris about 8 weeks before, only more so. They seized the factories, the hotels, shops, and cafes, and then they collectivized them. They spoke to each other now as equals, and they looked each other in the eye as they walked down the Ramblas. There, in the heart of the city, they gathered and sang revolutionary songs, of the sort that George Orwell, when he arrived 4 months after they, would find the naivest kind, all about proletarian brotherhood and the wickedness of Mussolini. Everything in the streets of Barcelona in those extraordinary days was, as one young socialist put it, dreamlike, everyone hallucinating with happiness. One spectator speculated that it was like the day of festival in older times. They arrived in early August, 3 weeks after the city's liberation. When she arrived, the social revolution was still in full force. Yet, as when she had visited the occupied factories near Paris earlier in the summer, she was struck in Barcelona by the calm and good spirits surrounding her. In her journal, she wrote of stepping out of the train station and strolling along the city's happy streets, the cafes and shops open and serene. "Nothing has changed, really," she suggested, "except for one little thing. Now the people have the power." But from that exception, much ramified. She wrote that as she scrutinized her surroundings more carefully, noticing, for example, so few police and so many kids with guns, she came to realize that, surface calm notwithstanding, this truly is revolution. They had come to Barcelona, however, not to soak up the scene, but rather to fight in the war. She had done so because she saw it not as only a Spanish civil war, but also as a global one. She saw the war as a great scission, splitting all humanity into enemy camps and impassioning partisans the world over with hatreds for newfound nemeses, even among old neighbors. And she saw the war's implications extending across vast, overlapping ideological, political, and moral terrains. They was far from alone in seeing things so, as more than 40,000 people from beyond Spain left their homes in Ethiopia, the United States, Cuba, Palestine, and many other countries to join in a struggle that they interpreted as their own. In even those parts of the world most distant from Spain, the war worked to accelerate an ideological sorting out already underway, intensifying changes already begun in how people imagined the world's politics and in how they imagined that they themselves could shape and turn those politics. When the war had begun in late July, they had been at home in Paris, away from the fighting, and yet nonetheless she had already felt implicated, because despite my best efforts, I couldn't keep from subjectively participating in this war. In the end, whether she had been right or wrong in Paris to see the war as her own, her choice to engage, as she put it, worked to make it so. By engaging, they and all of the thousands of others who went made sure that the war would indeed hold just the sort of global implications that she had sensed were there when she'd decided to catch the train to Barcelona. Consider another personal political trajectory, contemporaneous with Vay's, converging with hers in Spain. Follow Oliver Law from the south side of Chicago to the battlefields of Jarama. On a pleasant Saturday afternoon at August's end, 1935, Law stood on a roof near Chicago's 47th Street L station and gave a speech. Below, an excitable crowd filled the street, assembled in protest of the Italian fascist regime's ever-escalating threats to invade Ethiopia. Law had put considerable work into organizing the demonstration, and after the police had rejected the organizers' application for a parade permit, he had been among those who insisted on holding the event regardless. Now, on the roof, he had a lot to say. A black veteran of the United States Army, he had become politically engaged during the earliest, most desperate days of the Great Depression. He had taken part in 1930 in Chicago's unemployed movement, both before and after officers from the police department's Red Squad beat him senseless with blackjacks, and he'd taken part the following year in local protests against the incarceration of the Scottsboro Boys, the 9 black youths unjustly accused of rape in Jim Crow, Alabama. He had joined the Communist Party USA the year after that, and had risen quickly in the local branch's ranks, even running for office on the party ticket in 1934. Meanwhile, he had driven a cab, loaded ships along the docks, worked construction for a spell, and also opened an undercapitalized restaurant, which quickly failed. A profile of him in the Daily Worker suggested that he considered his political engagement during these early years of the Great Depression a turning point in his life, protecting him against defeatism and demoralization as a result of the failure of his business. By the summer of 1935, when he threw himself into the local effort to protest the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini's warmongering, he already had a sizable reputation in Chicago's radical circles. The mass march down 47th Street was far and away the largest of the anti-war demonstrations in Chicago that summer, with some estimates suggesting that 10,000 took part. In fact, it was one of the largest of all the many hands-off Ethiopia protests that swept through the world's major metropolises in 1935, everywhere from Melbourne to Calcutta and London to Rio de Janeiro. And in addition to the thousands of protesters who showed up on 47th Street for the march, hundreds of police officers also showed up to break it up. One observer even felt that the officers with their patrol wagons made a bigger and far more spectacular parade, as white and black citizens of both sexes were herded indiscriminately into the vehicles and hurried off to precinct police station cells. While Vey the following summer would find herself struck by the surprising calm of a factory occupation near Paris, Law, in the summer of 1935, had to handle the predictable pandemonium of a street demonstration in Chicago. Indeed, that was why he was on the roof. A few bold protesters attempted speeches down in the street, but they did so at their own peril. As Law and the other organizers had expected, as soon as anyone in the crowd popped up her or his head with an eye toward giving a speech, the police began to make their way through the mass of people to arrest the offender, clubbing marchers along the way. This meant that street-level speakers had to melt back into the crowd before they could make much of a point, leaving it to someone else, somewhere else, to pick up where the last speaker had left off. That kept the oratory on the street somewhat impressionistic. It also made the oratory something of a cooperative act of speech, one improvisational discourse blending into the next. This had its own expressive elegance to it, and its implications, most of all in their material form, that of the police clubs, had a way of leading participants to draw solidarity-generating connections between the dangers faced by the people of faraway Ethiopia and the dangers that were their own right there in Chicago. But on the roof, Law had time to pursue his point. It appears that nobody documented what he said that Saturday afternoon, but he inevitably spoke out against the growing menace of fascism. If other speeches given during the Hands-Off Ethiopia campaign provide any guide, he said something to the effect that the Ethiopian people's fight against Italian fascism belonged to all people everywhere who opposed fascism anywhere, much like what Vey implied one summer later when she considered why she felt that she had to take the Spanish people's fight as her own. What is known about Law's speech is that, his rooftop remove notwithstanding, it ended with the Chicago police hauling him off to jail. 16 months later, Law left Chicago, for Spain. Like Vey, he saw the Spanish Civil War as a fight that belonged to all, and he saw it as a fight over the greatest of stakes, the choice between fascism and the possibility of a better world. Along with five others, he caught a train to New York sometime after Christmas 1936 and set out across the Atlantic on a steamer on January 16, 1937. Only weeks later, in the Jarama Valley east of Madrid, he took command of a racially integrated machine gun company, an accomplishment, it was pointed out, that hadn't been possible when he had served in the U.S. Army. His choice of solidarity with people far away had opened possibilities of empowerment for himself. And as he had in Chicago, he achieved recognition and respect at Jarama. A reporter who interviewed him on the front in the spring of 1937 observed that Oliver Law stands out for his leadership, his coolness, and his gallantry. In the interview, Law spoke openly of the possibility of dying in Spain, but again, like Vey, he thought that taking part was incumbent upon him, and he explained that he fought not out of humanitarian sympathy for the Spanish people, but rather out of human solidarity with them, the Civil War ultimately as much his own concern as theirs. He explained, "We'll do it here in Spain, maybe stopping fascism in the United States, too, without a great battle there." Vey and Law, Paris, Barcelona, Chicago, and Jarama. The sit-down strikes, the hands-off Ethiopia movement, and the Spanish Civil War. Explaining the connections between such people, places, and events, and explaining the possibilities opened by these connections, are two of this book's central aims. That Vey's and Law's life stories converged in Spain serves as a nicely illustrative geographical representation of a much larger story of convergence, that of the left during the middle years of the Great Depression. The left in those years came together across divisions of political geography, race, nationality, empire and colony, language, political affiliation, and ideology, to achieve a fleeting and fragile but meaningful semblance of unity. This book maps out that convergence. It is a history of the left at a moment of its remaking into something new and more substantial than what it had been before, and into something more familiar to our notions of what the left means today. Indeed, one of the more general claims of the book is that much of what we now think of as the left turns on what happened in this short historical period. This is so in even the most fundamental of ways. For the mid-Depression years, those years leading up to and culminating in the Spanish Civil War, were when the basic idea of the left as some great aggregate of people who find common cause with each other the world over finally took form. There had been, to be sure, other notions of the left in political rhetoric for a long time before these years, but those were smaller and less consequential conceits. Only when the generation of Vey and Law took to the political battlefield in the 1930s did the idea of the left swell into the distinctive shape and size that it has had since. Only then did people take to reckoning that the left was something at work the world over, something that included masses of people in different countries all over the world, all at once. And indeed, for the most part, only then did the left transform in people's minds into the sort of thing that could be imagined to be at work anywhere, or to do anything at all, that it could be imagined to act in the simple sense of possessing and exercising an agency all its own, as if the left were a sentient being like you and me. It is the sort of political fiction usually taken for granted. It is today, and has been for a long time, quite commonplace in political talk for abstractions like the left somehow to act on their own, to perform even audacious acts, to hold specific beliefs, and to make clear-voiced declarations. Listen to everyday political chatter and hear that the left fights for certain causes and battles against others, that the left takes stands and makes demands, that it keeps the faith or loses faith, that the left occasionally wins great victories, even though its usual lot has seemed to be to suffer terrible defeats. The left argues, insists, struggles, demonstrates, and remonstrates. It organizes, mobilizes, dreams, pleads, and protests. It is, again, as if the left were alive, flesh and blood. How to explain this being so? How did it come to be that people today would reflexively express such belief time and again in everyday political discourse in the agency of a mere metaphorical figure? Why is it such common sense that the left is something at all, let alone something capable of taking part in the great political contests of the day, contests over the fate of humanity? One way of explaining it is to suggest that we have learned to think of the left as a political collectivity. Our politics teems with such collectivities, which is at least noteworthy and perhaps alarming, because they are all fictions of a sort, inventions of the mind that only exist to the extent that people believe them to. And yet we allow these fictions considerable power to shape our lives, to shape our world. In part, this book tells the story of how people around the world came to believe in the left, the same as they could be said to believe in any of the other great phantasmic collectivities that inhabit our political world, strange and inevitably mystifying creations such as the people and the working class, or any given nation or social movement or political party, or any and all of our most familiar ideological specimens, those such as the progressives, liberals, socialists, populists, and conservatives, or, of course, the collectivity that is the left's natural corollary, the right. Like the left, the right and all of the rest of these political collectivities first needed people to imagine them into being for them to exist at all, and they will last only so long as people persist in believing in them. Beware them all, warned the newspaper intellectual Dorothy Thompson in the final days of the 1930s. Thompson, a widely syndicated columnist for the New York Herald Tribune, insisted that many an intellectual problem, and it followed many a political problem, stemmed from faith in abstractions like masses, proletariat, liberals, progressives, Tories, CIO. They were all, to her mind, illusions, phonies, she called them. And yet even Thompson, the shrewd skeptic of ideological abstraction, had learned by the 1930s end to trust subconsciously in the veracity of at least one collectivity, only a few lines after she warned against putting any stock in those phony abstractions, she then invoked the left as if it were as solid as cement. In our time, as in Thompson's, it's a question worth asking. How is it that people would put so much faith in these abstractions, these phonies, to signify actual political creatures living among us? The various stories of these political collectivities' makings, taken together, tell an important part of a larger story, the story of the making of the modern political world. In this book, I relate one of those stories with an eye toward that larger one. There are endless ways to relate the history of the left. The historical moment at the heart of this book, the middle period of the Great Depression, is far from the only point of origin for the left as we know it today, and this book's narrative is far from the only origins story for the left that could be told about even this historical moment. Any political formation, such as the left or the right, or communism or liberalism or conservatism or any of the other phonies, is necessarily complex and has multiple origins, and any one of its points of origin can be narrated in any number of ways. Nonetheless, this book relates the origins story for the left that I thought I could tell, and that I thought made sense to tell in our time. The most familiar origin story for the left that could be told is a much older one. That story, explaining the spatial metaphor behind the name the left, reaches back to the first year of the French Revolution. The episode, only later invoked as the left's origin, unfolded as part of one of modernity's most myth-laden political dramas, the excited debate in Paris and Versailles over the rights of man during the extraordinary summer of 1789. In the weeks that followed the storming of the Bastille in Paris, deliberations in France's Revolutionary National Constituent Assembly at Versailles became so intense that the deputies who were most taken with the metaphysics of rights, liberty, and equality gradually took to sitting together on the chamber's left side so as to make their case more forcefully physically unified. It may seem like an inconsequential habit, but it had force. Right away, it made those congregating on the left into a collectivity, however small and impromptu, and they sensed this to the point that it altered their behavior in the chamber. What was most noticeable was that their heckling and hissing now drove their adversaries, those protective of social hierarchy and the authority of church and crown, over to the room's right side. By August's end, after those on the left had won their greatest triumph with the issuance of the World Historic Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, those who felt themselves cast to the right and much aggrieved by it began, as one of them put it, to recognize ourselves. In a way, that self-recognition was the origin of the right. In a way, then, the left had not only been present at its own making amid the fabled events of the summer of 1789, it had compelled the making of the right by reaction as well. And it was precisely in this way that many later political actors and thinkers took to seeing the matter. They looked back at the clamor at Versailles and found in it a parable of collectivity making fit for their own times. Small-scale and situational as the affair had been, it nonetheless looked to them like an origin story for the left and the right, and it looked as well like an origin story for the whole of modern politics in all its factious, collectivity-driven, and grievance-ridden glory. But only in retrospect. Neither the left nor the right had sprung forth fully formed in 1789. At the time, nobody in the assembly had imagined that the occasional gesture to the left as the side of equality, the rights of man, and social justice would someday be projected beyond their chamber, let alone beyond France. The periodic single-room face-to-face gathering of deputies during assembly sessions was a thing of a different kind from what the left has meant since the day of Vey and Law. Only since then, since the middle years of the Great Depression, has it made sense to people to imagine the left as not just a collectivity, such as that congregation of revolutionary deputies at Versailles, but as what you might think of as a mass collectivity, that is, as a vast aggregation of people likely never to meet each other and whose solidarities rely always on their imagining themselves and each other into a common vessel, such as the left. And in a parallel way and for parallel reasons, only since the middle years of the Great Depression has it made sense to people to imagine the left as what you might think of as a global collectivity. That is, not only composed of many people, but moreover composed of people in many places all over the world. The left as we know it today, and it has been known since the generation of Vey and Law, is something dramatically universal, something seemingly at work in any and all of the world's political provinces all at once. By contrast, before those middle years of the Great Depression, the left meant only smaller and disparate things. And indeed, throughout most of the 19th century world, people made only sparing use of the French revolutionaries' imagery, sorting out political beliefs between left and right. More to my point, though, is that on those occasions when people in the
sample complete. Ready to continue?